it. Her smile now conveyed her savoring. Abelard nodded, but slightly. She went on, "My uncle has permitted me to be here in the rear corner of your lesson hall for 3 days now. I find you unconstrained in your thinking. You go where it takes you. I have learned the rules. Now I would learn to break them. Keep the rules, dear sister, and the rules keep me," she said. "I know that. Would you teach me or not?" "How would that work?" he asked. Here it was. Abelard felt ambushed, not by her request, which he had seen coming, but by the resistance he felt. Not to her mind, which beckoned as an open sky beckons the bird, but resistance rather to that bare suggestion of her breasts beneath the monkish garb, resistance, therefore, to her body. No, to her body, in perfect combination with her mind, the joining that so enlivened her amazing face. It was a rare thing for Peter Abelard to feel the stirring in his loins, but there it was. A man of continence, long without women, he had a fine, nurtured habit of turning efficiently away from such feeling, but now he did not. Still, he was like a war dog, tensed for danger. He glanced at Fulbert as if it were the canon to whom he had put his question, not himself. Fulbert said, "You would take up residence here on the close. I would have you named to the College of Canons Regular." Fulbert paused. The Canons Regular at Notre Dame lived a quasi-monastic life under the rule of St. Augustine, a reforming impulse aimed at retrieving the ecclesiastical discipline of the early church. Abelard did not react. Fulbert shrugged. "Or, once named as a canon, you could simply join my household, a sort of chaplain. As a courtesy to me, you would offer a private tutorial now and again to various members of my domestic sodality. No one need know to whom, precisely." "The bishop?" Abelard asked. "No one need know," Fulbert repeated. It would not serve his purposes for the bishop to know of his kindness to the cousin of the king's wife. But the king's wife would know, which might, in a time of intrigue, prove useful. Abelard shook his head. To be in conspiracy with the unscrupulous and self-promoting Fulbert was a further risk. Abelard cast his eyes about to be sure they were unheard, and he was startled to see in the shadow the expressionless brother thrall, whose gift clearly was for making himself invisible. Within earshot of all that the canon had said, the service held himself as if he had heard nothing. But to Abelard the jeopardy was clear. Prudence presented its mandates. 1. Stay out of intrigues between bishop and king. 2. Cavete feminam. Females were excluded from cathedral study, and for good reason. For this reason. Out of the question, forbidden. Such violation of the order of the school would be dangerous for a man of Abelard's prominence, whatever it was, to the conniving canon. But in the brief joust over Saracens and philosophers, Peter Abelard had just been bested, and that set the old beguiling impulse of contest moving in him. Plus, the young creature was beautiful. "What is your name?" he asked. "Eloise." He saw her. He loved her. And so, likewise, Eloise, him. Chapter 6. Since 1948, the chancery of the archdiocese had been in the south wing of the Villard houses, a sprawling Roman Renaissance palazzo on Madison Avenue, immediately behind St. Patrick's Cathedral. The place had been built by a 19th-century railroad tycoon, whose heirs were taken down by the income tax, the market crash, and the dislocations of two wars, making way at last for Francis Spelman, the shoemaker's son who secretly believed himself to be a prince, a Borgia one at that. The stately complex featured Tiffany glass, Lafarge murals, and bronze fixtures by Saint-Gaudens, but those names were merely names to Michael Cavanaugh. Enough for him that the palace splendors were of another order entirely, not his. He tried not to judge, but really. As he mounted the grand staircase with its polished pink marble under flashing chandeliers, its oriental runners with brass fasteners, the elaborately carved oak wall capped by the huge seal of the archdiocese, the tasseled cardinal's hat, the Greek cross, the flame, the motto, Fiat Voluntas Tua, he felt as out of place as ever. The effort, simply to carry his weight up the staircase, one raised foot at a time, registered as a coming headache. He shook it off and chastised himself for this smug alienation. The good works of the church were focused on parishioners like his own, including the poorest people in New York. Offices in this building, the Catholic Guardian Society, the Hospital Apostolate, Catholic Relief, Catholic Home Bureau, Catholic Schools, made that service real. And the people themselves would love this lavish place for belonging to their church, an immigrant's revenge. So who the hell was Michael Cavanaugh to be put off by his showy indulgence? The Villard houses were a celebration of Irish Catholic arrival, even if the arrival belonged to one man alone, Spelman, the self-styled American Pope. The building was as close as His Eminence would get to the Apostolic Palace in Vatican City. To come here was to risk running into him. And, yes, a headache was coming. On the second floor, under a barrel-vaulted ceiling and opposite a row of large windows opening onto a courtyard, the left wall of a long corridor was hung with portraits of crimson-clad Irish warlocks, Spelman's predecessors, Farley, Hughes, Hayes, as well as of beatified New Yorkers, Mothers Cabrini and Seton, and the Jesuit martyr Isaac Jogues. Beyond a large, sterile fireplace with a flamboyant marble mantel, Cavanaugh came to a set of double doors, on one of which was a small brass plate stamped with the words, Episcopal Vicar for Clergy. He entered. A plain woman of indeterminate age looked up from a ledger on her desk. She wore rimless spectacles, her lank hair in a schoolmarmish bun. With an unfriendly expression of surprise, she took in the sight of him, his black suit and clerical collar, the omnipresent breviary under his arm. On the wall behind her was a Baroque painting of the risen Christ. Below that was a file cabinet. That Cavanaugh did not know the woman made him realize how long it had been since he'd come to Sean's office. "I am Father Michael Cavanaugh, hoping to see Bishop Donovan." By way of reply, the woman glanced at the ledger and appointment book. "He's not expecting me," Cavanaugh said. "One moment, Father," she said. She stood and disappeared behind a further pair of walnut doors. A moment later she returned, and without disguising her disappointment said, "His Excellency will see you." Bishop Donovan's office, in contrast to the opulent public spaces of the chancery, was sparsely furnished. An uncluttered U-shaped desk in the window alcove, a tired leather couch adjacent to an off-kilter butler's table, and a Windsor chair that had lost its sheen. Against the distorting glass of the leaded window, spindly bare branches scratched like fingers in the November wind. On one side of the alcove hung a simple crucifix, and on the other was a photo of the Pope, his familiar gaunt profile, spectacles glinting. Bishop Donovan came toward Cavanaugh with his hand extended. He was well into his 60s now. His hair was white, his skin ruddy. His black cassock and purple cincture hung loosely on a frame made for more weight than he was carrying. A gold cross swung from the chain at his chest. "Father Michael Cavanaugh, what a pleasant surprise!" The man's happiness was unfeigned. "You are very welcome, dear Michael." Only now did Cavanaugh allow himself to feel that his odd waking impulse to come downtown was right. "Thank you, Bishop," he said. "Cut that out, Michael," Cavanaugh grinned. "Thank you, Sean." "Not agent?" Cavanaugh laughed, then so did Donovan. In truth, the old priest was proud of his long-lost nickname. They sat, Cavanaugh on the sofa, the bishop on the chair. Cavanaugh placed his breviary on the cushion beside him. "It's been what, most of a year?" the bishop said. "I thought I'd see you at the Holy Thursday Gaudiamus." "I was at Tenebrae, of course, in the cathedral, in the shadows. Who doesn't love the extinguishing of candles? But I couldn't stay for the reception." The bishop nodded pleasantly. "Tenebrae is my favorite liturgy of the year. Shouldn't say that, since it's all about the death of the Lord. But I love getting the fellows together afterward. Gaudiamus, let us rejoice. Some take offense at the priest party I throw on the eve of Good Friday. Not me, Sean. Just couldn't get there." "What about next week? My Thanksgiving shindig for the fellows. Wednesday night, I've lined up Patricia Murphy's swell place, Candles Galore. You coming?" Cavanaugh hesitated. Once, he'd relished the lubricated company of his fellow priests, but the edgy banter of such gatherings had gone stale for him. What was the Latin for, "Let us trade barbs"? He said, "I don't imagine so, Sean. Wednesday nights are tough. You know how it is." Sean replied, "Ah, busy parish priest, right. I have the impression, speaking of candles, that you're burning yours at both ends. I hear from Frank that you're working too hard, Michael." Bishop Donovan picked up a pack of cigarettes from the coffee table, shook a pair up, and made the offer. Michael took his. He supplied the light, a match. Waving it out, Cavanaugh said with abrupt solemnity, "What else do you hear, Sean?" "What do you mean?" Cavanaugh's mood had come between them. His headache was full bore by now. "From Runner Malloy, John Malloy." The bishop did not reply, but neither did he lower his eyes. Cavanaugh said, "John Malloy came to Good Shepherd yesterday, to the early mass. He disappeared before I could speak to him. I was left wondering how he knew where to find me." Still the bishop said nothing. "Then it occurred to me, you told him. Before he came to Good Shepherd yesterday, he would have come to see you. I haven't seen him in all these years, but you have. You're in touch with him." Cavanaugh waited. Then he added, "Am I right?" The bishop took a drag, then leaned forward to roll the tip of his cigarette in the ashtray. "It's true," he said, but carefully. "And you told him where I was. It didn't occur to me that he was of a mind to contact you." "He didn't contact me, that's the point. He was at the Mass. He came forward for communion but didn't receive. It threw me, a kind of message showing up out of nowhere, but also kneeling at the rail, then shaking me off when I offered him the host. What was that?" "I have no idea." "Then he stalked away." "That is odd." "But you've talked with him, Sean. You're in touch with him." "Not in touch, Michael. I had a letter from him, special delivery, out of the blue. Then he came to see me the day before yesterday. First time I've seen him since he left Dunwoody, what, 14 years ago?" "Yes." "It hit me yesterday, Sean, how, in all these years, you never mentioned him to me." "I'm aware of that, Michael. I'm also aware that you never brought it up." "You made it seem like the seal of confession, Sean, the private forum. How could I?" Instead of answering, the bishop drew in smoke. But yesterday, last night, Kavanaugh had to search for words, I realized how strange the whole thing is. Back then, you told me Runner left the SEM because of me. Not because of you. Yes, out of bounds, you said. Feelings for me that were out of bounds. Kavanaugh channeled his sudden agitation into the smashing of his cigarette into the ashtray. And you never discussed that with me? Out of bounds? For years, I thought I'd done something horribly shameful. A guy kicked out of the seminary because of me? Not kicked out, Michael. He would have been. He confessed his feelings to you, and then you convinced him to leave. But if he hadn't, you'd have seen to his being tossed. Bishop Donovan only eyed the tip of his cigarette. Then I'd have been tossed too, Kavanaugh said, with the sudden spleen of a man seeing a thing for the first time. No, Michael. Good God, Sean, you got Runner to resign as a way of protecting me. They'd have come after me. What's his name? The rector.
Tobin. Peter Tobin.
Right, Tobin. He wouldn't have thrown out just one guy for being... It was feelings, Michael, but only feelings. Damn right. Feelings are what brought me here this morning. Feelings I've never gotten free of. Something in me that was out of bounds. Obviously, I knew exactly what you had told me about Runner. But as for me, what the hell, Sean?
Kavanaugh checked himself.
The love of men for men, the bishop said quietly. We cannot even say the word, Sean. Yes, we can, if necessary. Is it necessary?
Kavanaugh shrugged.
The love that dare not speak its name? Don't be ridiculous, Sean. I was in the Navy, remember? Why do they let Marines on ships? Because sheep would be too obvious. But there's the point. Jokes like that are the big deflection. The Navy has nothing on the church. Sailors terrified of the blue discharge. And priests, you said it, burning the candle, CYO, basketball drills, hospital rounds, parish school, hearing confessions, keeping at bay, what? Feelings that are out of bounds? My idea of hell is an afternoon without appointments. Michael, the people love you. I'm not talking about the people, Sean, or about John Malloy, for that matter. I'm talking about you. You told me that my friend's first dream of himself was crushed because of me. From then on, my dream was sullied, and I was to pretend it never happened, which, God forgive me, I did. You're right, Michael, I protected you. From what? Tobin? Expulsion? No. From feelings I should have acknowledged. Feelings that were not out of bounds. Runner was my friend. My particular friend. And you made me the means of his betrayal. You betrayed us both.
You should have talked to me, Michael.
How could I? You hid behind the seal of the sacrament of penance. John Malloy was an occasion of sin. That is what you made me think. So I blanked it out all these years, Sean. You, who knows me better than anyone, and who...
Kavanaugh's voice trailed off. He wanted to say, who cares about me? But that seemed out of bounds. He let his silence make the point. Sean Donovan was no friend. The bishop did not pick up the thought. Finally, Kavanaugh asked, Why did we never discuss what happened to Runner? Why did we never discuss whether I am a homosexual? Are you? No. No. I am not a homosexual. It took me the war years at the Navy Yard to understand that. 3 years of loving men, actually. Men dying in my arms. Men whose cheeks I kissed, whose hands I held, hour after hour, whose faces I still see in my sleep. I loved those men, every blessed one of them. Homosexuality had nothing to do with it. But so what if I was homosexual? Is that what you thought to protect me from? Particular friendship, Sean. The great crime at Dunwoody. We were warned off it in a thousand ways. The threshold rule. No after-lunch walks in pairs. But what is friendship, if not particular? What other kind of friendship is there? Michael, you're not making sense. Maybe not, but that's because talk of this is branded as dirty, sealed off behind the seal. I don't buy it. Haven't bought it for years. Kavanaugh stopped. Indeed, it surprised him to realize he'd stopped to catch his breath. He'd gotten ahead of himself, but he just caught up with something, too. The bishop eyed him warily, and that also seemed an affront. Kavanaugh was far from finished. In the Navy, I told guys to relax if they felt guilty for getting laid. I tell inward plumbers the same thing, and also their wives. If they can't handle getting pregnant again, what is it with us and sex, Sean? God isn't sending people to hell over the rhythm method, no matter what the Pope says. Not over masturbation, either. The people love me? Of course they love me. I tell them to relax. What you tell people in the confessional is not my business. Out of bounds? What was that? I'll tell you, Sean, exactly what it was. You are on your own, bud. That's the message, and I've been hearing it all these years in a voice I've always known but could never quite identify. You are on your own, with feelings of grief and confusion and loss and loneliness. I saw it yesterday. I have not had a particular friend in all these years, not since Runner Malloy. That's why the sight of him threw me so. Simple friendship. That's what's out of bounds. You made it an issue of homosexual love. What's the phrase in canon law? Crimen pessimum, the worst crime? No. Wanting not to be alone, that's the worst crime. Michael, you need to stop this. Right. Stop the feeling, shut up about it, sit on it, bury it. How? Why, light the candle at both ends and let the mother burn. You are on your own, bud, and what I've just realized is that the voice telling me that all these years has been yours. Donovan shook his head, sadly. Nothing wrong with wanting not to be alone. Who wants to be alone? That's why we have the common room in every rectory. Michael said, each with its bottomless bottle of Chivas. It's not for Chivas that the fellows come to my shindig on Holy Thursday, Michael, the one you are too busy to attend. It's for the friendship you claim to want. No, Sean, it's for clerics cutting each other down to size. What passes for chummy humor, priest to priest, is sarcasm, and you know it. I bailed out on that bullshit years ago. My goodness, Michael, this bitterness is so unlike you. It is me, Sean. You are remembering your friendship with John as something golden beyond compare. Bishop Donovan leaned to the ashtray and tapped it, without breaking the practiced rhythm into which his speech now fell, a stilted rhythm, pretending to be easy. A beautiful nostalgia. He had assumed the mode of pastoral counselor. But perhaps that feeling of intimacy was, don't misunderstand, a bit of a boyish infatuation, that you have nothing like it in your life now. Could that just be a simple measure of manly maturity? Boyish infatuation, manly maturity. What are you saying? I'm saying life is hard, Michael. Toughen up. Kavanaugh laughed abruptly, even as blood rushed to his face, and his headache spiked. The bishop's rebuke surprised him, yet so did his own readiness to be chastised. Self-doubt loitered in Kavanaugh, like a tumor in his lung. He knew that what Bishop Donovan said was true. He was prepared to think ill of himself, and here was another reason to do so. Toughen up, indeed. His skull was cracking. For want of something to say, he turned to his breviary, opened it, and took out one of the several printed bookmarks. He read, "To live in the midst of the world with no desire for its pleasures, to be a member of every family yet belonging to none." "Like that, you mean?" "La Cordaire," the bishop said. And he recited from memory, "To daily go from men to God, to offer him their homage and petitions, to return from God to men to bring them his pardon and hope." Not a bad vocation, that, Michael. "To bless and be blessed forever," Kavanaugh read. "O God, what a life, and it is yours, O priest of Jesus Christ." Kavanaugh slipped the bookmark back between the pages and put the book down again, an act of punctuation. For a long time, the two men sat in silence. Finally, Kavanaugh asked, "So what is it with John Molloy?" "I can't discuss that." "Seal of confession?" "Or that." "What can you tell me?" "He's a teacher, a school in New Jersey, a coach. He was dressed like a stockbroker. It's that kind of school." "Why did he come to Good Shepherd?" "Beats me, Michael." "Did he talk about me?" "Not really." "Not really?" "I can't discuss it, Michael." "Can you put me in touch with him? I'd like to see him." "If he gets back to me, I'll ask him. Otherwise, it would be a violation." "But you felt free to point him to me." "Not the same." Now, when Bishop Donovan stubbed out his cigarette, it carried the meaning that the session was over. Session. Not old friends together, not even counselor and client. Kavanaugh saw suddenly. But employer and employee. Both men stood. Kavanaugh's gaze went to the crucifix on the wall, then to the portrait of Pius XII. "Something else, Sean," he said. Bishop Donovan smiled, a full display of official but still genuine benevolence. He was a good boss. "Anything, Michael, anything at all." "Simone Weil." "The French saint?" "Was she a saint? I've been reading her book. She was never baptized. She wouldn't join a church that claimed the right to say anathema sit." Donovan snorted. "We don't say it that much anymore. You said it to Runner." "No, I didn't. I told you at Good Shepherd yesterday he knelt there but didn't receive communion, as in excommunicated. That's what you'd done to him. That's what he was telling me." "I protected you." "What did I need protection from, Sean?" Bishop Donovan did not answer. The silence grew, becoming a kind of presence in the room. At last, Kavanaugh bent over to pick up his breviary. Straightening, he asked, "Was Simone Weil an anti-Semite?" "Good God, no. She was a Jew." Kavanaugh nodded and turned. That he left the room without a word of farewell was, he knew, quite rude. He did not understand what was happening to him. The morning sun washed down on Madison Avenue. The sidewalk was crowded with workers and shoppers, all happy, all moving briskly in the November chill. Kavanaugh stepped into the rush. He was wearing neither a topcoat nor a hat, and this emphasized his clerical suit. Passers-by, as always, made way for him. Normally, aware of the impression he made as a priest in public, he would return the nods and smiles that the clerical collar drew from strangers, but not today. By the time he reached the nearest corner, he had to move out of the human current. "What's happening to me?" He pushed to a lamppost and leaned against the stout, grooved metal, clutching his breviary, indifferent to appearances. His breath was short again. He looked skyward as words came unbidden into his mind. Perhaps he spoke them. "Non credo." Chapter 7. "And can you believe it, Philintus? Canon Fulbert allowed me the privilege of his table and an apartment in his house. You, my dear friend, know what love is. Imagine, then, what a pleasure it must have been to a heart so inflamed as mine to be always so near the dear object of desire. I would not have exchanged my happy condition for that of the greatest monarch upon earth. I saw Eloise, I spoke to her. Each action, each confused look, told her the trouble of my soul. And she, on the other side, gave me ground to hope for everything." That first morning of what became their articulated attachment was, in fact, their eighth time together. They were in the cubicle off the main scriptorium, the large room in which the copyists tended to the cathedral's collection of ancient texts. Abelard routinely held his tutorials there during terce, when the cathedral scribes, bound to the hours, would be at choir, and he could offer instruction without an audience. Through a single small window cut a wedge of light that illuminated, for the necessary period, just the square of space the master and his pupil needed to do their work. In the bright air stood a small table and a pair of chairs. Their table. Their chairs. In truth, Peter Abelard's condition was not as happy as, much later, he made out to Philintus, as no one knew better than Eloise herself. His infatuation with her had come at him like ambush, an assault of feeling made worse by the feelings being necessarily and absolutely secret. In the early weeks, he had thought it secret from her, but wrongly. It had not occurred to Abelard that she could match him in fixation, even if she was made less distraught than he. A man of no carnal experience, he was far more afraid than he was delighted. In what became his famous letter to Philintus, as in much-sung lyrics he himself went on to compose, he described a storm of exuberant lust that promptly blew through the wills and consciences of a pair of formerly disciplined ascetics. "The same house, the same love, united our persons and our desires. How many soft moments did we pass together? We made use of all the moments of our charming interviews. In the place where we met we had no lions to fear, and the study of philosophy served us for a blind." Eloise well knew it was not like that, although she, too, would later look back through a scarlet lens. In fact, they were a pair of timid neophytes, gingerly circling each other. Abelard and Eloise now sat across from each other, as they had been doing at this hour twice a week for a month. They had fallen into a routine of stiff formality, a proper custom, and each assumed it must continue. Between them was a small stack of wax tablets, on the likes of which Eloise had been presenting her translations of Cicero and Ovid into Greek. At first, she had protested this novice exercise. Rome had surpassed Athens, and Rome's language, her own language, was the pinnacle of expression. She assumed that Master Peter was simply testing her knowledge of Greek, but she was wrong, as she began to understand this morning. He had come to his real subject, a slant. Metamorphoses, he said. Ovid gives us the word for the transformation of essences, an ingenious coinage in our tongue. Yet he has the word from the Greek. Metamorphoses, she said, speaking the word not in Latin, but in Greek, with its proper accent. Change of form. Precisely. But is change of form possible, he asked, when one thing becomes another? Does it not cease to be one thing? Can it really be another? Translation is the case before us. She said, anima into psyche? Good. The soul in one language, yet something more like the mental faculty in the other. Shades of distinction. Distinctions lost in the handing over from tongue to tongue. In your translations, sister, you do not succeed in carrying the full meaning of Ovid's thought from Latium to Attica. Master Peter indicated the tablets between them. I find no equivalents. My translations are accurate, Eloise said quietly. She picked up the stylus to stop her hands. It looked like an oversized needle, a sharp-pointed utensil carved from the leg bone of a cow the color of charred wood. Yes, wonderfully so, Abelard said, but accuracy is not equivalence. That is my point. No equivalence. Translation claims to be a kind of metamorphosis, but is not. No idea ever remains the same when it is translated, not even when translated with such brilliance as yours. Give me an example from today's passage. An example? Of metamorphosis. Actaeon, the hunter, into a stag, the hunted. Yes, good, the teacher said. But he could be seen to stifle a pang, and Eloise supplied its source. Actaeon, the Theban hero, wandering through a forest, comes upon a sacred grove in a small lake of which the goddess Diana is bathing. Actaeon beholds her nakedness, the mystery of her maidenhead. For this violation he is, snap, changed into a four-legged animal. At the evocation of that pool, with its attendant nymphs, Eloise, knowing more than Abelard, sensed how both of them were seized by an image of the goddess in her glistening wet flesh, Diana's arms raised to gather in the spray of her hair, her flawless breasts all the more alluring for being so innocently on display. As if to deflect an actual vision, Abelard's eyes fell, but Eloise saw them settle upon the embroidered yoke of her own gown. Above a tightly laced bodice, the gray, tufted fabric rose with her breathing. Despite having no experience of men, she knew that his mind, thus set loose, would conjure her breasts, too, tumescent, erect, like the breasts of striding female figures in marble, Minerva, Juno. Surely the classic statues of Lutetia would have been his only points of reference for the womanly nude. But at that moment, the flesh to be seen of Eloise in all apparent modesty was nothing more than the hollow of her throat, set off by a thin golden chain. Her fuller neck would be a deep red, pulsing with life. He composed his voice to say placidly, still, identifying the animal with the prince, we are expected to regard the stag's fate as tragic. She said in her best pupil's voice, Actaeon's own hounds kill the stag, not knowing it is Actaeon. But there's the point, he declared. The stag was Actaeon, but is no more. Our identification is in error. The tragedy is false. Abelard tapped the topmost tablet, a teacherly gesture. He was now enacting a role, controlling himself. "The power of the myth," he continued with apparent calm, "lies in this deception. We grieve the slaying of the prince when, in fact, a mere animal has met an animal's proper fate by offering us one such instance of metamorphosis after another. A Roman, Ovid, not just drawing on the Greeks but mocking them, is showing us that there is no such thing as metamorphosis. Essences are not mutable. Things are what they are, that is all. It is an urgent point, a rebuttal, in anticipation of the mistake that comes later with Plotinus, the confusion of matter and form. But the chaos of primeval origins is transformed into the order of Rome." Eloise, too, could perform. "Is that not the poet's true subject?" "Indeed, you perceive the depth of things, girl." "Why do you call me girl? Why not woman?" "Why did you choose Actaeon of all the myths?" Eloise lowered her eyes, as if found out. "Diana threw water in his face," Abelard said quietly. "The curse that changed him into a beast. Why?" "Because he spied her." "And saw?" "Her body unclothed." Eloise had the stylus now firmly between her two hands, pressing the thing as if to snap it in half, staring as if to see the exact moment of break. Then all at once she raised her face and brought her gaze directly to Peter Abelard's. Each of them was blushing. She said boldly, "But is there shame in a body unclothed, master?" "I would think not. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. But that was before the sin of Adam. Adam's sin was in loving Eve too much, nothing more. But the sin falls upon us all," she said. "So the fathers instruct. We are the mass of perdition, soul-wounded children of Eve. We come into the world naked, and our nakedness makes us ashamed." He said, "What norm of justice is it that accuses an innocent child in the presence of God, our most merciful judge, of the sin of the parents? That norm of justice would not stand in any court of man, therefore neither will it stand before the judgment seat of God. If the doctrine of ancient sin means the innocent are doomed, then the doctrine is wrong." Abelard's words took on a sudden heat, as if he had debated this question in solemn disputation. "Is God cruel?" he asked. "Does God will the destruction of lives rather than the fulfillment of what he has created? What sort of God is this?" "How do you renounce settled doctrine?" she asked. "By thinking," he said quickly. "About God?" "About the simple question. Who would sit blissfully for all eternity in the presence of a monster?" Peter Abelard challenged her with a fierce look. Eloise stared at him, her mouth agape. "In the great legend of their romance, under the pretext of studies, dear Philantus, she and I totally abandoned ourselves to love. There were more kisses than considerations of grammar. Concupiscence determined their fate. They were a lascivious pair who gave in to hurtful desire with dread consequences, the calamity, in Abelard's own word. This was the lecherous story that a mutilated man later told, to appease his disapprovers and to assuage his guilt. In the story, he was the prime mover, the willful seducer. She, the guileless quarry, though once incited to mad ardor, she never recovered. But that trite saga of Eros, explosively ignited, composed in the aftermath of an unspeakable punishment, deletes what was essential in the passion that first defined each of them, if separately. For Eloise, true, the manly beauty of her teacher, in combination with the physical charisma that drew legions to his lectures, was the beginning of attraction, but it was the free play of his mind that astounded her. He was unfettered not only by precept, but by power. "How can you say that?" she asked him more than once. His reply was constant. "I can say it because it is what I think." A savvy young woman, Eloise sensed that, despite the self-assurance with which the master carried himself, he was desperate for the praise of scholars. He would sacrifice for reputation's sake almost anything. But that almost was key. For the one offering he would not make in exchange for fame was the truth of his own thinking. And that, of course, was what brought him fame. But now, in her presence, another force was at work, and she understood it before he did. Abelard came most fully into a towering intelligence when, for the first time in his life, he felt its engagement physically. The body of Eloise, as it were, gave Abelard his body, and only then did he grasp the one proposition toward which he had been groping, even in philosophy, for years, namely, that the hard distinction between body and soul is false, therefore, also, between ideal and real, between substance and form, because it is what I think. But thinking, in this woman's presence, was not what thinking had ever been before. Thus was fulfilled and released what had been an implicit, unadmitted impulse from their first meeting in the cathedral refectory, hemmed in by obnoxious young scholars with Canon Fulbert standing by. Yet the first true coupling between the storied Abelard and Eloise, and surely for these two it had to be like this, was of the mind, the furthest thing from profane desire. Their connection was the sacred revelation of word become flesh, incarnatus est. Abelard was hardly breathing, rock still. Yet she sensed full well the new meaning of it when he circled back to the lesson. "Translation," he said at last, "is never fully true. There is no such thing as the total transformation of essences. A thing is only what it is." Eloise remained fixed upon the stylus between her fingers. "But what of the bread and wine?" she asked, so quietly. "Transubstantiation in Greek, metousiosis." Abelard did not reply. This was a swerve, as she knew it would be, for which he was not prepared. She said, in her recitation voice, "But if the word of Elijah had such power as to bring down fire from heaven, shall not the word of Christ have power to change the nature of the elements? That is Father Ambrose." She paused. She was in earnest, yet she was also extemporizing. "Hoc est enim corpus meum," she said. "Bread into flesh, wine into blood. If that is not metamorphosis, what is? The bread is no longer the bread. The bread has become the body of Christ. Christ himself said those exact words, hoc est enim corpus meum, which is why the priest must repeat the exact words. The words must be fully true to have such power. The exact words effect the change of substance, of essence." "No, dear girl, not those exact words." Abelard took refuge again in teacherly condescension. "The scrupulous priest, pronouncing each syllable for efficacy, is a superstitious fool playing at magic. The Lord did not speak those exact words for the simple reason that he did not speak Latin. Saint Jerome spoke Latin. Father Ambrose spoke Latin. Not Jesus. Well, the Greek then, she said. The words Jerome translated. The meaning is the same. Not Greek either, he said. The Gospels are Greek, but Jesus was not. He spoke the language of Jewish peasants, a local dialect, not even Hebrew. Jesus spoke, and his words were translated by those who loved him. The translation was then translated again, still with love, yet with shifts in meaning at each point, shifts in meaning not only in his words, but in the matter of the sacrament itself. This is not a trifling matter. Peter Abelard's gaze had fixed her sternly. He went on, launched now in a serious discourse. The bread he held up before the apostles was not what we think of as bread, even at the Holy Mass. It was matzah, of which we read in Exodus, the unleavened festival food of Jews. The Last Supper, before it was a Mass, was a Passover meal. Before it was Catholic, it was Jewish. Does that fact of the past change meanings of the present? How could it not? Pascha, Misa, the two things are not the same. Only in seeing that do we see the separate truth of what each one is. Was Jesus saying what we think he was saying? We cannot know with precision. The faith involves not meaning, but meanings. As for transubstantiation, that high-flying word owes more to pseudo-philosophers than to the Lord. To him, if he were here today, the word transubstantiation would be babble. Abelard reached across the table and closed his hand around her joined hands, the stylus. Things are what they are. This writing instrument, he said quietly, is only a writing instrument. Eloise shook her head. No, not now. She, the one who knew, met his eyes. It is the instrument of our intimacy. He rose from his chair, leaned forward, and placed his mouth upon hers. Surprising herself, she brushed the tip of her tongue against his lips, which opened. At that, she pressed the bone stylus against the pivot of her thumbs, but it did not break. Even in holy places, before the altar, I carry the memory of the guilty loves I shared with you, dear Peter. And far from lamenting for having been seduced, I sigh for having lost them. I remember, for nothing is forgot by lovers, the time and place in which you first declared your love to me and swore you would love me till death. Your words, your oaths, are all deeply graven in my heart. In the scriptorium after that first kiss, they found themselves again and again embracing, bringing their clothed bodies together, a pair of novices whose moves were marked soon enough by an instinctive proficiency. Peter pressed his hands against her bosom, but in that schoolroom dared not unwind the back laces of her bodice or push into the linen bands that kept her breasts high. For her part, Eloise, acting on instincts she didn't know she had, pressed him through his rough woolen tunic, first at his shoulders and sides, then into his lap, below his cincture. She was startled to feel him aroused and stiffening there, startled and transported. When, once, Her clutching hand sensed a throbbing inside the cloth. She recognized an instance of the storied ejaculation, even as his groans announced it. She was appalled that she had herself caused this animal response, but at the same time felt a thrust of her own feelings that was not so different. She was shy with this initiation, virginal, and she was afraid. Yet she found herself rubbing him like that again, and when he reached into the underskirts at the delta of her legs and pressed, she followed him up successive hills of sensation, unsure what was happening but giving herself to it. Only when he pressed his hand against her mouth did she realize that she, too, was making dangerous noises. In those first weeks, each time they arrived at the point where the only way forward was through the full stripping off of robes, skirts, and underclothing, they stopped. Rather, she stopped them, for her terror continued to outweigh the longing she was not prepared to acknowledge as lust. Only much later, in looking back, did she understand that that combination, dread and desire, defined the euphoria that had taken them captive. The fullness of time was bound to come, and, with the great Compline on the solemnity of the Annunciation, with its prostrations, litanies, and venerations of icons, it did. The ceremony was followed by the festal night collation of wine and cakes, an exceptional revel, which they knew would send all the cathedral fellowship into the deepest of sleeps. After the canons, choristers, acolytes, servants, and members of Canon Fulbert's personal household retired for the night, Eloise and Abelard, separately, waited in their chambers while the silence settled upon the cloister. To that day's lesson in the schoolroom, Abelard had brought a pair of small candle stubs, each the exact length of the other. He'd opened his palm so that she could see them, and she'd understood at once. She had sensed his uncertainty. His hand was tremulous, but passed it by, taking a candle stub without comment. She quenched her own uncertainty by pretending not to feel it. This deliberate setting of a plan was blatant, and part of her marveled at her readiness to embark upon it. The other part simply trembled, whether with fear or anticipation she neither knew nor cared. After the collation, they went to their separate quarters. Immediately after the Nunc Dimittis, the night dismissal chanted by the porter through corridors, hall, and dormitory, the master and his pupil, before dousing their oil lamps, used them to light their small candles and, hiding the glow, separately watched them burn to the point of extinction, which was the signal. They quietly left their chambers to meet in the cloister garden, where, beside the singing fountain, they embraced and kissed. Eloise was cloaked and veiled, but with his hands at her face, Peter jolted back at the realization that her long brown hair was unpinned and flowing, a downpour to her shoulders, the first time he had ever seen it so. He pushed the hood of her cloak down, exposing her head. He clutched fistfuls of her hair and roughly pulled her face to his. Overcome with trepidation, she turned her head away, but nevertheless clung to him. She yielded as he led the way toward a corner of the arcade where there was a broad bench. But the wind was howling off the river. It was too cold. Peter stopped them, held Eloise briefly at arm's length, then took her by the hand, saying, "Come." Again she yielded. He knew the way. His eyes were better in the darkness than hers. He led her into the gallery that brought them to the cathedral porch, where he found the heavy door that opened into the downward spiral staircase. Their blind hands rowed as guides on the rough stone wall as they descended into the crypt, where their eyes opened to the faintest light as they entered an eerie, becolumned, low-vaulted chamber. Off the multiple stout pillars and ceiling groins, shadows bounced, thrown by the winking flame of the vigil candle that was kept burning in the distant chapel of Our Lady of the Undercroft. The chapel nestled in